Appeals this afternoon, where we have one case set for oral argument. Before we get started, I will introduce the panel that we have. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand that the lawyers have all checked in and explained the time split among the appellees that has been requested and that we will allow. So without any further ado, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call 02-25-043-CB, Borgonis versus Holtzclaw. May it please the court. Mr. Aaron Katuluk will argue for appellant. Ms. Rachel Williams, Ms. Shelby Hall, and Ms. Kathleen Gogol will argue for appellant.
Thank you very much. All right, appellant may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. This appeal arises from the trial court's grant of traditional and no evidence summary judgment on a case that is replete with disputed facts. What the sellers knew, what their agents knew about serious structural defects, what they disclosed, what was not disclosed, what they affirmatively represented, and what was misrepresented. All of those, when viewed under the summary judgment standards, it's clear that this case cannot be resolved as a matter of law. This case revolves around a house at 5001 Pinehurst Drive in Frisco, Texas. The sellers in this case initially purchased the property on May 26, 2014. Within days of purchase, the sellers commissioned engineers, an engineering firm called TCS Engineering, and that was on June 9th, 2014, a report was delivered to the sellers. That report noted significant foundation issues that needed to be addressed. Less than 2 years later, on April 13th, 2016, Jensen Engineers, who we'll hear a lot about today, delivered another report to the sellers, noting, among other things, continuing significant differential movement and structural distress. That's at CR Clerk's Record 2309-10. Interior foundation elements not performing as intended, requiring immediate remedial action, that's at CR 2310. Structural sagging, particularly and dramatically on the second floor.
Now, didn't the buyer's own real estate agent provide evidence in this case that they received a copy of that report through the seller's disclosure notice?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm glad that was brought up. The buyer's agent was a man by the name of Hunter Dane, and he did testify that it was his belief that they did receive it in some hard packet or some brochure during an initial viewing, but he did equivocate. And Hunter Dane actually, it said CR 1377-78, he said, quote, talking about the packet, it contained a lot of paper in it that looked like it very possibly could have been an engineering report, but I did not physically take possession of that packet. So the only gray area is the very specific details of what was inside, and that's exactly what's at issue here, is what was inside that seller's disclosure notice. The main position has been that the buyers received it in this initial viewing in a hard packet, but there's no definitive evidence that that happened. Hunter Dane also testified at CR 1385, stating again that it was his belief that they did receive the reports. So
yes,
then it comes down to
a question about your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
On pages 20 and 22, and then on page 26, when you're discussing reliance, you highlight your client's testimony apparently about the discussion when they were initially looking at the house. And then he said, it was at that moment that I decided to buy the house. And you suggest that reliance occurred at that point in time. Don't we have to look at the contract as well and the disclosures in the contract as to whether or not his reliance was reasonable?
Yes, Your Honor, yes. You will have to look at all the evidence in the case.
And item number 13 on the disclosure statement says, basically it says, instructs the seller to list and attach any inspection reports. And it says, mentions Jensen Engineering, and it says attached, yes or no, attached, yes. Even if it wasn't attached, didn't that prompt a duty of inquiry on the part of your client?
He's testified under oath that he did not receive that Jensen report, and there's no...
I'm conceding that it's not attached, but didn't it prompt a duty on his part to say, hey, let me see the Jensen report?
I wouldn't call it a duty, Your Honor. I'm not quite sure it'd be a duty. It should maybe have prompted a couple of questions. There's no perfect answer to this. This is not a perfect case, Your Honor. I concede that as well. But the issue is that even if the Jensen report was attached, like it says it was, there's still this TCS engineering report from 2014.
But that was earlier. I mean, wouldn't it be reasonable enough for the sellers to say we attached the most recent thing because that's showing the current state of the house and whatever was revealed 2 years earlier is really kind of neither here nor there.
That would be the case, Your Honor, if it wasn't for the real estate agent's promulgated form. So the form that they created, that seller disclosure notice, if you look on section 12, and that is, it's on section 12 of the SDN. I apologize, I don't have the CR case citation or the citation right here. But on section 12, the question that is asked is, or have you received any reports in the last 5 years detailing the need for repair? So in that, it's clerk's record 814. It's the SDN asking whether the seller has received any report about the need for repair or replacement in the last 5 years. I would argue that TCS report certainly does fall into that, and it is relevant that within 2 years they had two separate engineering reports. So the first one apparently did not get resolved, and I think the Jensen report speaks directly to that the repairs were not done sufficiently such that...
Well, so that would be... I mean... Here again, I guess it goes back to Justice Basil's question about let's assume that the Jensen report was not attached. If your clients had asked for it, they would have seen the Jensen report's statement that whatever was done before wasn't good enough. So I'm troubled by the fact that either they got it and didn't pay attention or they knew that it was there and didn't ask for it.
It could, especially
in an as-is contract. I mean, this is not like, for example, our most recent case, I think, is that FAM case where there was no disclosure made at all about any problems that the sellers knew about. And here, wasn't there enough to put your clients on notice that they needed to at least ask more questions?
I would argue no, Your Honor, simply because if you look at the seller's disclosure notice, everything on there says adjustments and repairs have been made. There's nothing on there that says in need of repair, which we know is false, that most of these repairs, at least one particular repair, did not get made.
Okay, but
go ahead.
I mean, and that's all very good and well, except that do you dispute that the testimony that Mr. Argonis, when he first walked in the house, said, you know, oh, my gosh, this place has foundation issues? I mean, wasn't it sort of open and obvious, if you want to look at it that way?
I would say no, it wasn't open and obvious. It might have been obvious that there was foundation issues, but then he was reassured by the real estate agent saying, nah, everything's been repaired.
But if you can see, I mean, it's like you walk into a house and it's on fire, and you go, my gosh, this house is on fire, and the realtor goes, no, you know, that's taken care of, don't worry about it. I mean, can you really put your head in the sand like that, I guess, is what I'm asking.
In that case, no, Your Honor. If it's on fire, no, you definitely cannot. I would say specifically there were hidden defects. There may have been some foundational issues that were obvious and maybe should have warranted further inspection, which
we
did.
Didn't your client testify, if we assume your client had notice of the Jensen report, that if he had known what was in the Jensen report, or they'd known what was in the Jensen report, they wouldn't have bought the house.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The specifically, I was just wanting to point out that the second floor is a lot of the issue here. The Jensen report specifically recommends that ceiling framing beneath the sagging elements of the second floor should be exposed. And so that means opening up the ceiling, and it needs to be examining the existing framework to determine the necessary reinforcements. And he says, quote, "It is anticipated that steel beams will need to be installed in the ceiling. For this reason, foundation repairs should be delayed until second floor framing modifications are determined." That never happened. That second floor opening of the ceiling, none of that ever happened. So those were kind of latent, hidden defects up in the second
floor.
Now,
how does that tie in with, if I'm remembering the record correctly, I'm sorry if I'm getting the facts wrong, but wasn't there testimony that because the original cedar shake roof had been just overlaid and added weight, and the house wasn't constructed originally where the load-bearing walls were going to absorb all that? I mean, that was addressed, wasn't it?
I think there was a joist issue that I'm no housing expert, I'll admit that, but there was some work done on that second floor by Rob Sexton, who is not an engineer and did not even know about the Jensen report. He didn't know that this directive was in there, that this should be happening, the ceiling should be removed, basically opened up to be examined. So he made some carpenter's adjustments up there. He did make carpenter's adjustments, but the Thompson Foundation firm, they didn't even look at that. And they understood that there was a directive from the Jensen Engineering firm to open up that ceiling and to do that before the foundation repairs were made. They just didn't do it. So, Your Honors, importantly, again, I'd like to reemphasize the TCS report from 2014 was not attached or referenced in the SDN. So we already know that there are certain portions of this SDN that are not accurate, and arguably misleading. There's at least evidence of that. There's at least evidence that Mr. Ogonis relied on the representations that the house had been repaired, that there was this warranty, whether it be a lifetime or a transferable warranty. There's a lot of confusion, especially in the record on both sides, about what this warranty was. And I think that is evidence of at least a fact issue of what was represented.
Well, and again, I'm sorry if I'm misremembering the record, but is it accurate the way the appellees portray it, that the only reference to a, quote, lifetime warranty was Ms. Gibson's erroneous mention of that in an email to the sellers and not represented to your clients?
There was that piece. That is not the only piece. The other place it appears is the agent's office, and I think it's someone by the name of Laura Higgins. I don't know if that's actually correct, but it's clerk's record 1849, and that's someone from the agent's office reaching out to Thompson Foundation asking about a, quote, lifetime limited warranty for Pinehurst.
Okay, but that was not something that was stated to your clients as an affirmative representation that, hey, this foundation has a lifetime warranty?
That's correct, Your Honor. It was not directly. It's really, we only point that out to know that there is some confusion on here. There is a question about what was represented, what kind of foundation. Even if it was not a lifetime warranty, it was in just a transferable warranty. There is the record of at clerk's record 1850, that's saying that Ms. Gibson is saying, so basically this is expired. It was very much, I think it was in an August 18th, 2017 email. The closing had just occurred on August 11th. So pretty much a useless warranty. And there is on the record that Thompson may have been willing to extend that a certain amount, but it's also on the record that his foundation is not a foundation warranty. It is basically a warranty for the things that he did, these certain repairs that he did.
Right. So the attachment to the original petition, part of the seller's disclosure notice and all of that has, I think it's at page 67, has initials of the buyers and the sellers that I take it is a was a an addition to the seller's disclosure notice. That's that October 18th, 2016 email from Mr. Saltzbaugh to Ms. Gibson, you know, saying the attachment from Thompson should be attached to our disclosure form, and seems to be that's what it was. And that wasn't that attachment from Thompson what says it's a one-year warranty?
That would have been, but Joe, Mr. Argonis has testified that he never received that, and there's no definitive evidence of what that. I think that's the PDF that's like 0.015. Is that what you're referring to, Your Honor?
I'm not sure. Oh, yes, right, the scan.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But let's say that scan 0015 was something totally different. But again, you know, we've got your client's initials on something that says, Kathy, the attachment from Thompson should be attached to our disclosure form. I mean, if it wasn't attached and your client's initialed this, would it have been reasonable for them to not ask for it? Same with the Jensen report.
I would agree it would have been smarter in hindsight. Everything was always easier in hindsight. I can't say I don't think there's anything on the record saying why his signatures appear on these when it says attached. But he has said under oath in testimony that he did not receive these materials. And I'm out right now. Can I just finish this thought, Your Honor?
Let me ask you one more question.
Yes,
if
Your Honor.
Your client is chargeable with notice of the Jensen report, and he testified that he would have not bought the house if he had had the Jensen report, isn't this case over with respect to the seller and the real estate agent?
I would argue no, Your Honor. I would still say that there are questions of fact that need to be resolved by a jury.
Are those questions?
Say again, Your Honor.
What are those questions?
What was misrepresented? Why were these material? Why does the seller's disclosure notice say everything has been repaired? Why is everyone telling them that it's been repaired? And that could have induced some form of relaxation when you're signing and putting initials down. I would just say that it is important, the jury system in this case in particular, because it's a community of your peers. And so this is a house in the area. These are your neighbors. They need to decide who is right and who is wrong. But that'll be okay. Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Oh, quite all right. So, Ms. Williams, are you arguing first?
Yes, Justices. Okay. Your Honors, I'm Rachel Williams. I have the privilege of representing Bill and Sharon Saltzbaugh, the appellees and sellers in this matter. And it's our position that this is an open and shut case. There are two relevant pieces of evidence, the contract and the attached Jensen Engineering report. And that is why, over and over again, I counted 8 times in appellant's brief where they tell you the seller's disclosure notice omits mention of the Jensen report. If they had been honest about the facts in this case, their brief would have told you 3 things. Their contract gave them inquiry notice of the Jensen report, at the very least, as a matter of law. They contractually agreed it was attached. Then your only question is, what does the Jensen report say? Does it conceal issues or disclose them? It's uncontroverted that it discloses issues. As you noted, he testified he wouldn't have bought the house if he had known about these issues. It unequivocally put them on notice. Second of all, I'd point out that their appellate brief never mentions to the court that they knew enough to not only get a general property inspector, but specifically a structural engineer, Lighthouse Engineering, out to inspect the whole home, because they testified they were experienced home builders who had built pier and beam foundations themselves multiple times. They said they knew enough to go get a structural engineer to evaluate the whole home. The final thing I'll say that is not necessary for you all to affirm, because I think the facts defeat misrepresentation, causation, reliance as a matter of law. But one thing that sets this case apart from FAM, Bernstein, any case where this court or any court has held judgment for the buyers is there wasn't any harm because the Sulzbas went above and beyond. Not only did they disclose the issues, they disclosed everything Jensen found before it was fixed. Then they fixed it. And Jensen came back out and said, the repairs have been completed in substantial compliance with my report. That's why, if you go look at this record, you know, in the FAM case, those buyers bought the house, and then they had 15 feet of water coming in there. I know you all know this case, but there's water coming up, flooding over a retaining wall, over a pool, 15 feet into your house. They had to pay for that. That's a big, significant defect that should have been. What is wrong with this house? And I just heard the counsel for the Ergonises speak for 15, 20 minutes. I read their whole brief. I've looked at Mr. Lingle's report. That's their hired litigation expert. What does he say? The floors slope slightly south, but it has been repaired, and the slope is within overall industry accepted limits. You know what you won't see in the record is any evidence that the Ergonises have had to do any foundation repairs because the Sulzbas didn't have to do them, but they did. So I just point that out. They haven't spent a dime. They haven't done anything. Their own expert says the house is sloping, which they unequivocally knew before they bought the house.
What about the TCS report that from 2014? Does that have any bearing on this case?
Well, it's irrelevant because the contract discloses the Jensen report. And I'll point out two things. One is that the inquiry is, did the Sulzbas give an ordinary buyer exercising due diligence enough information that they knew to go inspect the home? And they did. We know that because of Colby Johnson, and we know that because of Williams v. Dardeen, and we know that because of their own conduct in hiring a structural engineer and in saying, I knew the house had foundation issues. But the other thing I want to tell you about the TCS report, because I've read it in detail, that was a predecessor report that, frankly, if my clients had disclosed that instead of the Jensen report, they might have misled somebody because they had had that years earlier. It was very short. It was 2 pages. And it did not say there's significant issues. It actually sort of made it seem like they were no big deal. And it said they were easily repairable. So the Sulzbas, in reliance on the Swetman report, did go repair those. They had Powerlift come repair those. It wasn't until a couple years later when they had an AV guy under the house that said, Mr. Sulzbas, you might want to get someone out here to look at your foundation. And this time they said, well, we better get somebody very reputable because I don't want to do this again. They got Jensen Engineers. Jensen Engineers did a much more comprehensive report. He just found a lot of issues, and he said, look, your prior repairs weren't sufficient, and it requires further remediation. They disclosed that. You know, at his testimony on the record, when I asked Mr. Ergonis, I pointed out that October 18th email you said, and I said, it says right here, these documents should be, the Thompson records should be attached to the seller's disclosure. Does that look like people who were trying to conceal records from you? And he said, well, no, it doesn't. If they had wanted to conceal issues, they wouldn't have disclosed the Jensen report. That was the more recent comprehensive report, and they can't point to a single issue they would have figured out from reading the Swetman report that wasn't described in much more detail in the Jensen report, and then some. I'm going to release my time to my other counselor here and let Ms. Hall, and unless you all have any further questions for me, judges.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court. My name is Shelby Hall, and I represent Appalese Ebbie Holiday Real Estate Incorporated and Kathy Gibson. Now, the court has already heard the arguments presented by Ms. Williams on behalf of the Sulzbas in a discussion of the FAM case, and why the as-is clause in this case is dispositive. Because under this court's precedent, if there's no showing of fraudulent concealment, the as-is clause is dispositive on the issue of causation. Now, I would like to kind of pivot a little bit and talk about what these allegations are specifically as to Kathy Gibson, who was the Sultzbaugh's real estate agent during this transaction. So I kind of like to characterize it as there's kind of three buckets of representation that they say support their fraud claim. So there's the first bucket, which is a failure to disclose the Jensen Engineering report. The second bucket is verbal representations that Ms. Gibson supposedly made in open house. And then the third bucket is the idea about this kind of lifetime warranty. So turning to the first bucket, which is dealing with, you know, was there any representations regarding the Jensen Engineering report? I won't go on too long about this because I think it's been discussed at length, but I will just say that the record evidence is uncontroverted that this was in the property information booklet. And Joe Ergones and Linda Ergones both concede in their depositions that they were given a copy of the property information booklet, which did contain the Jensen Engineering report. Kathy Gibson testifies to this, that it was a part of the report that she handed them at an open house. The record is silent with any controverting evidence showing that the property information booklet that she handed them did not have it in it. The only evidence shows that it was in that booklet. They concede to receiving it, and they concede that they didn't read it. Joe Ergones testifies, well, it was a big packet. I did not read it. And so that's how we know that on this record, we've conclusively negated that specific allegation in support of these fraud claims. Now, moving to the second bucket that we're talking about, which is related to verbal representations. And so there's some deposition testimony from the Ergoneses where they talk about Kathy Gibson said that the foundation was solid, that repair work had been done. That was not a misrepresentation. The documents that Kathy Gibson had that were in the property information booklet show that, yes, there was a Jensen Engineering report. And then there's a document from Thompson Foundation Correction System showing that this repair work had been done. So this wasn't a misrepresentation. I believe the record says there was something like 180 feet worth of steel beams that were replaced underneath the foundation as part of these remediations.
What about the appellant's argument that what Jensen had suggested be done with regard to the second floor, that was not done, that Thompson didn't address those problems?
Your Honor, as to that, specific to Ms. Gibson and what she knew, so when we're looking at this, these claims as to Ms. Gibson, we have to look at what was her knowledge, because I haven't touched on this yet, but Texas Occupations Code section 1101.805 says that there has to be knowledge that she's making a misrepresentation. On this record, I don't think it's clear on this record that the repairs were not adequately done, because we have the record showing that Jensen Engineering said, yep, these repairs were done in accordance with our report. But even assuming that they weren't done correctly, even assuming there were still issues that needed to be remediated, which we don't concede, but even assuming that for the sake of argument, there's no evidence on this record that Kathy Gibson knew that there was any problems left with the foundation. She was entitled to rely on the representations of the Sultzbaugh's, because under this court's precedent, I think it's the Kubinski case, this court said that real estate agents and brokers, they have no duty to disclose facts unknown to them or to do their own independent investigations to uncover any defects in a property. So under that precedent, regardless of whether the repairs were done adequately on the second floor, to her knowledge, she did not know that. She was, all the representations that she was making were based on her knowledge. She had no reason to do any independent investigation, and there's nothing in the record to show that her reliance on the Sultzbaugh's representations was ill-founded. Turning next.
Let me ask you one question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you saying the evidence is conclusive that it was in the packet, that the Jensen report was in the packet?
Yes, Your Honor.
But Mr. Ergoneses testified, I testified this document was not in the packet.
He also testifies that he did not read what was in the packet. So his deposition testimony is, I received it. It was a big bound booklet, and I did not read it. And then, so Kathy Gibson, who in her affidavit says this was in there, and you can actually see in the record that it's a scanned copy of a spiral bound document. You can kind of see the shadow in the record showing that this was what the booklet was. And her affidavit is the only testimony that proves up what was in that booklet. And Mr. Ergoneses' testimony is conclusively disproven by his own further testimony that he did not read what was in the packet. Now, regarding the transferable lifetime warranty, again, Your Honor pointed out that there's nothing in the record showing that that representation was ever made to the Argonises, or that Kathy Gibson ever misrepresented the scope of this transferable warranty. And again, as Ms. Williams noted and has been discussed, that was document was attached to the seller's disclosure notice from Thompson Foundation that laid out exactly what the scope of the one-year warranty was. So for those reasons, there were no misrepresentations. Now, I would like to turn briefly to the element of kind of knowledge or intent. It kind of changes depending on what claim we're talking about, but it's all kind of the same inquiry, and it's, did Kathy Gibson know she's making any representations? Did she have an intent to defraud the Argonises? And here, their briefing really focuses on, you know, she had a financial interest. The Sulzbachs were her VIP clients. And it's for those reasons that, you know, we can infer that she had an intent to defraud, and that simply cannot be enough to raise a fact issue on a fraud claim, because those are present in every real estate transaction. I would hope in every real estate transaction that my agent as the seller thinks I'm a VIP client, and they're always gonna have a financial interest in an outcome. So that cannot be enough to raise a fact issue on the knowledge or intent element.
We'd have to assume that they're all crooked to reach that conclusion.
Your Honor, as Kathy Gibson's counsel, I have to vehemently disagree with this characterization. Yeah. But, Your Honor, but even assuming, and this just can't be enough in a real estate transaction that would give rise to an intent element of a fraud claim. Yeah. And when that's present in every real estate transaction. And just very briefly, there can be no justifiable reliance. The court's already touched on the fact that the Argonises noticed, there was the testimony from the record where I think Ms. Argonis says, you know, her husband told her, Linda, my God, this house has foundation problems. And, you know, Mr. Argonis testifies that he tripped in the kitchen because the slope was so bad. So even if there were remaining issues, they could not justifiably rely on any representations from the Sulzbachs or Kathy Gibson as part of this transaction. And I see I'm running very short on time, so I would just briefly conclude with, you know, typically in an oral argument, I would like to use my last 30 seconds to give the court the easiest path to affirmance. But in this case, it really is an issue of any element that you look at, of any of their causes of action, it fails. They fail to raise a fact issue on every element. So it's not an issue of best path to an affirmance. It really is any path in this case, any element of any claim you look at, they have failed to raise a fact issue. And for that reason, the trial court got it right, and the court should affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Gogol, I guess you're batting cleanup for the appellees.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did I pronounce your name right?
You did, Your Honor. Gogol. May it please the court. Your Honors, there's been, I apologize, I represent Paul Wood Inspection Group, Caleb Wood, and James Patterson in this matter. There's been a lot of conversation about the biller, the sellers and the seller's agent and the purchasers. I have a completely different issue here today, and that is summary judgment was granted for my clients on the limitation of liability provision that was included in the contract. The argument that appellants have made in their brief is that the limitation of liability provision was a pre-injury release. In fact, the case law does not support that. The one case, which is Arthur's Garage versus Raquel Chubb Security Systems, it is cited in both appellant's brief and Paul Wood Inspection Group's brief. It specifically deals with a pre-injury release, a indemnity provision, and a limitation of liability provision. The appellants have cited the case law that applies to the indemnity provision. They've cited that we should have to prove, or we had to show that there was express negligence and that the provision was conspicuous. That's not the test for a limitation of liability provision. Separately, in that same case, the court deals with the limitation of liability provision. And in that case, in fact, it's misnamed as a liquidated damages provision. And the court still provides the test to, one, determine if it's a limitation of liability provision, and two, determine whether it's enforceable. That test is, if it's a limitation of liability provision, it sets the upper limits of the amount that's recoverable. That's exactly what this provision does. It says the amount that you can get from Paul Wood Inspection Group is $1,299, the amount that you paid for the inspection. Second, the court says, does this limitation of liability provision violate public policy? And really, the one test for that is, was there a disparity in bargaining power? The Argonauts had the ample opportunity to go hire a different inspector, use anybody they wanted, find a contract that didn't have this provision in it. Instead, they signed the contract, they initialed next to the limitation of liability provision, they agreed that that would apply, and they went along with this. They've made no argument on those elements for a limitation of liability provision. Because they've made no argument related, or they've made no argument there and made an argument that is completely inapplicable to limitation of liability provisions, the court made the right conclusion, granting the summary judgment on limitation of liability provision, and their ruling should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Katulik, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Sorry, I always hesitate when I'm not 100%
confident. Hey, it's a strange one, I'll admit.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Very, very quickly, I'm glad I saved some time because I did not get to the inspection group. This is the FLE has a lot of problems with our cases. Talking about Arthur's Garage, that case, they didn't get into the express negligence issue because it's already, the provision at issue already met the express negligence test. So that provision in that case says specifically, there shall, notwithstanding the above provisions, at any time be or arise any liability on the part of the seller by virtue of this agreement or due to the negligence of seller or otherwise. So it already meets it. I would argue that the express negligence test should apply to limitations of liability, regardless of if it's a liquidated damages clause, or I would argue it's more like a release, especially because...
Do you have a case that says that?
I do not, Your Honor. I could not find any case that expressly says that. Only that releases, in general, have to meet the express negligence test. And in the contract at issue, the limitation of liability itself says that the inspection fee paid to the inspector is nominal given the risk of liability. Does not mention negligence. I would argue that releasing your own liability above a nominal fee is a release and should have to meet the express negligence test.
Well, but it would, but I mean, maybe calling it a limitation of liability is a little bit of a misnomer because they're not saying sorry, I'm losing my train of thought. That clause still would require a client of the inspection group to show that there was some negligence.
Yes, Your Honor,
right?
And that's what we're asking.
Right, but then it's like, okay, if you prove that we're liable, then this is the outer limit of what we are going to be paying you for that liability.
Yes.
So it's not quite, to me at least, it's not quite an express negligence situation.
I would just argue they're what they're doing is releasing all liability above a nominal fee, so this $1,200 fee. They're just releasing all the liability above that. And if that's for your own negligence, it would seem to me the same logic would apply, that you do need to meet the fair notice requirements, the express negligence requirement of that fair notice requirement. Just a few other things. I apologize, Your Honor. There is evidence on the record that the repairs were not up to Jensen's recommendation. When Jensen gave this certificate of, or maybe a letter, an addendum about the, it meets substantially his recommendations, he didn't mention anything about Robert Sexton or the second floor. And in fact, there's evidence on the record that he never reviewed any of the repairs on the second floor and had no records of what the sellers did in the attic or on the second floor joist system. That's at clerk's record 2058-62. And he says the trusses in the ceiling / floor level, and the trusses, from my best research, are the structure of the ceiling. The trusses in the ceiling / floor level were looked at, but the sellers did not want to rip it down and reinforce. So it was a choice.
Now, when you say he says that, are you saying Sexton?
Jensen recalled that's what the sellers had told him.
Okay.
So they had looked at it, did not want to tear it down and reinforce. That's why there's a carpenter going up there and not an engineer, because they didn't want to do all that. And then in their seller's disclosure notice, they say nothing is in need of repair. but that recommendation by Jensen was a need for repair that was not addressed.
But don't we have a slightly different case here because it was an as-is contract?
Not if that information was withheld and not disclosed. So that and that in particular is the most glaring fact question that we have of what was represented and why was that not disclosed? Was it an error not to put in need of repair? Did you just think that it was all repaired? We don't know, but that's kind of the point right here, Your Honor, is that these are all fact questions that should be going to a jury so they can determine these things. The other thing I want to address in my short time left is that the agent's knowledge of the repairs or of the defects. So first of all, there was multiple emails to multiple communications with the agent saying that the house has no or the that they need to fix everything. We have a real need to sell. And then if I could just finish this one thought, Your Honor, thank you. The last thing at CR 1737, in the agent's deposition, she's asked, you were kept apprised of the development on the issue about the foundation and structure of the house, right? She says, somewhat, yes. And then later on, Mr. Saltzbo was keeping you apprised of what he was learning through this professional engineer you referred him to, right? She says, closer to the listing date, yes. So there is at least knowledge, or at least evidence that she had knowledge of what needed to be done with the house.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate the oral argument. It's been very helpful, and your case is submitted. And with that, you're free to go about your day.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second Division of Texas now stands adjourned.